This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. You know what I'm thinking, so I am not going to say it, but yes, those deep breaths get harder the more days this happens. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 25th day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So look, first of all, stocks go down too. Granted, not always so much so fast, but also they have been going up for a very long time now. And the COVID-19 news is alarming. But there's context to be had here, right? So we are going to do what we did yesterday, which is to say we're going to get Andrea Eisfeldt on the phone. She is a professor of finance at the Anderson School out at UCLA. Thanks for coming on again.
Thanks for having me.
So we talked yesterday, as I mentioned. Your gut reaction was, oh no, yesterday. As you watch today unfold, a more considered thought?
Yeah, I watched today and I thought, you know, I think people have been looking for good news for so long. They're still looking for good news, but they're reevaluating fundamentals. And I actually think that's a good thing. We had tax cuts, we've had low interest rates, we've had a strong consumer sector, but we want to make sure we're looking at fundamentals and not really trading based on sentiment. So I think this, I think the reevaluation of fundamentals is a good thing for markets.
It's a little painful though.
It is a little painful. Yeah, at a personal level, it's painful, but I think we have to abstract from the personal pain and really look at it as a scientist. You know, we want our asset prices to reflect fundamentals, so we actually should be happy when we feel like markets are acting rationally. We might have a little bit of an overreaction here. We have to see yet, you know, how much pain we have to go through with the coronavirus and its ultimate implications. Right. But at the same time, I think we don't want to trade on happiness and positive sentiment alone.
Fair enough. But that said, though, I'm going to do a quick behavioral economics thing here with you. You know how when the stock market goes up, there's this thing called the wealth effect, and everybody pretty much feels better because, oh, look, the stock market's up. What do you suppose it bodes for consumer confidence in this economy, which we say all the time is so critical, when something like this happens?
Yeah, I do think that there's certainly a negative wealth effect. We have to remember that, you know, less than half of the American population Yep. actually owns stock. But those wealthy people do have a large impact on the economy. And I do think that they will be feeling a little bit less wealthy after these last 2 days.
You busy about this time tomorrow if we need you?
I would love to talk tomorrow, Kai.
Andrea Eisfeldt is a professor of finance at the Anderson School out at UCLA across town. Professor, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
It was great to be here.
Okay, so to the epidemiological news here. The Centers for Disease Control said today it is not a question of if the coronavirus starts spreading here, but when, which is alarming. But the Department of Health and Human Services said that it'll have a vaccine in human trials in about 6 weeks, which seems quick. But there is a medical supply chain disruption question here to be asked about the coronavirus. Marketplace's Justin Ho is on that one.
Pharmacist Meyer Davidoff at the New Jersey-based Invictus Pharmacy has been getting a lot of calls from patients lately.
And of course, we do reassure them, tell them that everything's fine as of now.
Davidoff says most of the calls are people asking about respirator masks and flu vaccines. But pharmacists are concerned that if the coronavirus outbreak continues, it could start disrupting the drug supply chain, says Doug Hoy, who runs the National Community Pharmacists Association.
China controls the raw active ingredients for numerous antibiotics and other drugs.
Also, generic prescription drugs used to treat blood pressure and diabetes. And it's difficult for pharmacies to predict which drugs could be affected, says Nicolette Louis-Saint, the executive director of the nonprofit Healthcare Ready, which helps link pharmacists to drug suppliers. She's been tracking drug supply chains amid the coronavirus outbreak.
For many products and many classes of products, the supply chain looks different. So it's really hard to create a broad stroke assessment of the potential shortages or just challenges that patients may see.
The FDA says it's asked drug manufacturers to let it know if they anticipate any disruptions because of the coronavirus. And it says companies haven't reported any shortages yet. Ashish Jha at the Harvard School of Public Health says that's because the supply chain has some built-in safeguards.
For instance, if there's a pharmaceutical company in India that's, you know, manufacturing a drug where they get the active ingredient from China, those pharmaceutical companies in India often will stockpile a lot of that active ingredient.
And in the U.S., pharmacies have built-in safeguards as well. Meyer Davidoff at Invictus Pharmacy again.
We always have at least 2-3 months of any chronic medication the patient might have.
Davidoff says if there's a shortage, pharmacists could work to help patients find alternative drugs in the meantime. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
And on Wall Street this Tuesday, it has been a couple of days, huh? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're on week two, day two of our series, Reimagining the American Labor Force. 164 million of us in it, says the Bureau of Labor Statistics, from which we have plucked 10 roughly representative people and the jobs they do. Data and methodology, if that's your thing, at marketplace.org/work. What we're trying to figure out is this. These are the people making this economy work, but is this economy working for them? This is the United States of Work.
There's always things that you don't like about your job.
You work hard for what you want.
You know, every job has their ups and downs.
Whatever good job means.
I like the hustle. I like working fast.
That's not a career. It's a lifestyle.
Today, we're going to introduce you to Kate Bellino. She is 24, a new accounts rep at a First Bank branch in Centennial, Colorado. And like a lot of the people we're profiling, the job Kate has now is not the one she grew up thinking she would have.
Probably until my sophomore year of high school, I thought I was going to be a concert pianist.
Oh.
Yes. So, nope, I never thought I would be in a financial institution role in any type of its capacity. My very first job was working at a country club. And I think that's where I fell in love with customer service. I sold wedding dresses for 2 years and I was a wedding planner for 2 years and I loved the wedding industry and events. And that was kind of what I thought I was going to end up doing for the rest of my life.
As you can kind of tell, there's a but coming.
But, you know, I decided I wanted to go back to school after taking some time off, and that industry doesn't necessarily support the finances it takes to complete school. So I was starting to look at other options. And First Bank has just the most pristine work culture reputation. And that really drew my attention immediately.
Now Kate's balancing her new job with going to school to get her bachelor's. Kate's work at First Bank puts her into a group broadly defined by the Bureau of Labor Statistics as sales and office occupations. That's travel agents and telemarketers, mail carriers, and administrative assistants as well. 2 out of 10 workers in this economy are going to have a job in that category. If I walk into a First Bank branch in Centennial, Colorado today, and I spot you, what are you going to be doing?
You know, I will be doing probably everything and nothing. Sometimes I'm working reports, so it really does look like I'm not really working, but I definitely work every single moment that I'm at the branch. Sometimes I'll be up at the teller line helping out if we have a line. I could be opening up accounts, so I'll have 1 to 2 to 5 people at my desk at any given time, just chatting through their financial situation or any situations that they need help with. When you come into any First Bank branch, you will be bombarded with hellos. That is one of our best things about working for First Bank, is we take care of our customers and want everybody to feel welcome when they come through our doors.
Okay, it cannot possibly be all sunshine and light. So what's not so great about entry level work in the finance industry?
I have worked in several different industries, and there's always things that you don't like about your job. But truly for me, on my days off, I'm kind of a little sad that I'm not at my branch with my people. I have a great work team. We're like a family there. So this probably isn't the answer you want.
The answer is what the answer is, right? I mean,
right. I think something that a lot of people wouldn't necessarily know about a representative at a bank is there's a lot of back office work that goes on. And I think just the daily checklist that we go through gets a little tiring sometimes, because you're like, oh, I've done this over and over again. But it's just the process of making sure that our operations are running as smooth as possible. So while it might not be our favorite part, it's an integral part of our jobs.
Kate started at First Bank back in May, so not even a full year yet. So far, though, she's had 2 pay bumps and a promotion, and she's making more than she did when she was working in wedding planning. And Kate's got plans of her own, too. When she finishes up her bachelor's degree, she's going to apply for the company's management trainee program and continue her career there. This job is a stepping stone for Kate to the future she wants for herself.
One of the biggest draws of working for First Bank was their tuition reimbursement. And that was a huge reason why I needed to switch in the first place, is I was struggling paying for my personal finances, and continuing school and getting that degree is extremely important for me. So I've been able to continue going to school, continue paying for my rent and additional bills, my car insurance. I do have some student loans that I'm now able to completely take care of and not have to worry about, and still have a little bit extra Taco Bell money.
You got to do better than Taco Bell. Come on, man.
I do. But Taco Bell has my heart.
Look, to the bigger picture, though. I mean, you sound like you're doing all right, and life is working out for you. What are you worried about?
I'm worried that I'm going to be renting a small, tiny apartment for the rest of my life. That is one of my worries that I know it isn't. Well, knock on wood, won't be my reality for the rest of my life. But I really want to be able to be a little bit more financially independent by having a mortgage and having that money go towards my credit. And it's a little frustrating that I'm just paying rent and not being able to establish more of that financial security. But again, I know it's temporary. I just got to keep pushing forward, and opportunities will present itself when it's time.
That was Kate Bellino, new accounts representative at First Bank in Centennial, Colorado. Tomorrow, we are going to the other side of the country, the suburbs of Washington, D.C., to meet the second person in our sales and office occupations category.
When we're not busy, I kind of piddle through the store. I clean up the magazines. Mostly, my main job is to wait on customers, talking to them, hearing about whatever. I think I like meeting people.
In the meantime, you can read more about this series, why we're doing it, and how we found the people we are talking to at our website, marketplace.org/work. It's a bit tricky to see past all that red in the markets today in search of the bigger picture, but oh look, here's a thing. Home Depot announced better than expected fourth quarter sales and profits this morning, and wrapping up its year, it said same store sales, those are important, they were up 5.3%. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains how the company made that happen.
It's a tough world out there for brick-and-mortar retailers, so Home Depot has spent the last couple of years revamping stores, trying to streamline pickups for professional contractors, and improving its business online.
You know, you look at their online sales that grew 21% year over year, which, you know, is really great growth and is helping to drive some of that total same-store sales growth.
Liz Suzuki is a retail analyst at Bank of America. She says things like in-store pickup help convert those online shoppers to in-store foot traffic.
I mean, now it's, you know, 9-10% of their business, which, you know, for a category that is not traditionally known for, you know, having a big online demand, that's really pretty strong.
While the One Home Depot investments are paying off in some areas,
I think the surprise is that the demand was stronger from both the consumer and the pro or the contractor segment.
Ken Leon is director of equity research at analytics firm CFRA. He says a mild winter helped. Construction projects were able to keep going, which means more construction supplies. And there are some general trends in the economy that are showing up in Home Depot's numbers.
They're really getting the benefit where the consumer has higher household income. If you're looking to do a big project such as a kitchen, home equity loan rates are low too.
And those same trends are likely to help Home Depot competitor Lowe's, which reports its results tomorrow. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I was actually on the job getting real-life skills and real-life experiences.
Internships everybody does. What about an apprenticeship, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, more Wawa's. Dow off 879 today, 3.1%, 27,081. The NASDAQ off 255, 2.7%, closed at 89.65. The S&P 500 dropped 97 points. That is 3%. 31 and 28 there. Travel stocks were hit again. Tour and cruise operator Carnival sailed down 5%. Bunker fuel down more likely. There ain't no sailing going on, right? Royal Caribbean or Royal Caribbean, take your pick, dipped 7.3% today. Home Depot, Kimberly was talking about that. Yeah, down 9.1% today despite those fourth quarter earnings and revenue gains. Lumber liquidators left 18% on better than expected fourth quarter profit. Bond prices, that's where everybody's going as stocks sink. Prices rose, yield on the 10-year Treasury note down to 1.35%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The thing about COVID-19 that's driving the markets isn't totally what's going on in China. It's also what's going on everywhere else. More new cases in Iran and Italy and South Korea, to name just the biggest places people are worrying about. Also, the near certain prospect, as we talked about earlier, that it's going to spread elsewhere. In China, though, businesses are trying to start back up after the disruptions of the past month or so. But in the financial capital of Shanghai, things are still far from normal, as Marketplace's Jennifer Pack explains.
To be allowed back into Marketplace's Shanghai bureau, staff had to register with the building management, plus sign a form that says, "We promise to take steps to keep everyone safe from the virus."
Every day we need to measure our temperatures twice and wear a mask at work.
That's our news assistant, Charles Zhang. He set off in the rain to buy thermometers, disinfectant, and face masks. First pharmacy was closed, second one was out of what we needed, third one Charles had more luck at. But only a bit. The pharmacy had thermometers in stock, but not much else. There's still a huge shortage of face masks in the city. At another pharmacy, the staff say customers buy whatever leading Chinese epidemiologists recommend.
75% alcohol is said to be effective for sterilizing, so they're now sold out. Things that can boost the immune system, like vitamin C, also sell very well.
That's Miss Li, who won't give her full name because she's not authorized to speak to the media. Then she tells Charles to stay at least 3 feet away from her. Everyone is worried about catching the virus. Virus prevention rules vary between neighborhoods. Take Charles's apartment complex. A couple weeks ago, an announcement said only 2 people per household are allowed to go out at any given time, and residents who leave Shanghai will be forced to self-quarantine at home for 14 days when they return. In another part of town, businessman Wang Xiaojian has no such restrictions, but he did change his route to work.
There is a road I take to get to my office every day, but on the first day returning to work, someone stopped me and said the road leads to his village and only residents can use the street. It's a public road. Who gave him the right to block it?
Public uncertainty and fear have put China's government under pressure. People complain it didn't do enough initially to stop the spread of the virus. But in recent weeks, officials have taken care to issue guidance and prevent infection by making sure people don't crowd together. And it's up to residential committees and businesses to figure out the best way to do that. We checked our usual lunch place near the office.
Well, that restaurant was open all throughout the Lunar New Year, but now health officials told them they can only do takeout.
At our office block, everyone must be checked for fever before entering. But the handheld digital thermometers security guards use aren't that accurate. My temperature was in a normal range today, but there are days when I check in at a level indicating hypothermia. And we are required to disinfect the office every day. Our cleaner managed to make it into the office on the first 4 days after we returned to work, but not anymore. A neighborhood committee member says since our cleaner also works at other offices, she could have potentially picked up the virus without knowing. She's no longer allowed in our building. And what about disinfecting our office? Come back next week and check, the committee member says. Maybe the rules will change by then. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Here we are, as we've been reporting for a good couple of four years now, in the middle of an historically tight labor market, which means companies and trade associations and unions are looking everywhere they can for people to fill critical, skilled jobs. Here's a source that doesn't get a whole lot of attention in this economy.
apprenticeships. They're big in places like Germany and Australia, but the number of people doing apprenticeships in the United States has been climbing steadily the past couple of years. In 2018, the Labor Department says more than 500,000 people were getting skills while pulling down a salary at the same time. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on that one.
When Stan Best was finishing high school in the 80s, the path to a successful future was clear. Everyone from his parents to high school guidance counselor were in agreement, go to college. So that's what he did.
I went to Virginia Tech for about a year and a half, and I left before they could throw me out. I was responsible for paying for my own way.
And he wasn't getting much out of it. Then his brother encouraged him to apply for an apprenticeship at the Newport News shipyard, where workers built aircraft carriers and submarines for the military.
It's very pragmatic. It's very hands-on and practical with what the student is doing down on the waterfront.
Best trained as an electrician, went on to become a nuclear reactor test engineer, and eventually returned to the apprentice school to train future shipbuilders.
To tell somebody that is going to be a blue-collar worker that in the future you could end up with a six-figure job, it's not what they're normally hearing in the high schools.
Apprenticeships are mostly concentrated in the skilled trades. Unlike internships, they typically provide several years of on-the-job training. Apprentices earn a full salary and usually land a permanent job. Professor Joseph Fuller at Harvard Business School says expanding apprenticeships in the U.S. will take a change of thinking.
We have been preoccupied with a college-for-all mindset, and that is not bearing the fruit that we hoped.
He says too many young people are finishing college with huge debt loads and working in jobs that don't or shouldn't require a college degree. He estimates there are currently 3 million job openings in the U.S. where apprenticeships would make more sense, including many in banking, healthcare, and technology.
I didn't even know that there was a possibility for me to work in this field until I applied for the apprenticeship program and got accepted.
Tiffany Spriggins did her apprenticeship at Accenture in Chicago and now works as a software tester for the consulting firm.
I didn't have to go into debt and I didn't have to spend so much time in school because the time that I would have spent in a traditional program, I was actually on the job getting real life skills and real life experiences.
Nick Wyman heads the nonprofit Institute for Workplace Skills and Innovation and did his own apprenticeship when he lived in Australia. He says such programs aren't just helpful for job seekers. They can help employers address one of the biggest challenges in the labor market today.
Employers can't find the people with the skills they need, yet there's a lot of educational institutions that have been churning out people. So there's this labor market mismatch.
To help close that skills gap, the Trump administration is expected to finalize a regulation soon that will create a new kind of apprenticeship run by businesses, schools, unions, and other groups instead of just the federal government. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Dateline Burbank, California, by way of Mickey Mouse, Pixar, 21st Century Fox, and the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Disney announced today, kind of out of nowhere, actually, that CEO Bob Iger is stepping down. Like, today. Iger has renewed his contract a bunch of times the last 4 or 5 years. The last extension was through the end of next year. He, we learned today, is going to become executive chairman. Bob Chapek is the new guy, most recently the head of Disney Parks Experiences and Products. All right, we're going. The Dow off 879 points today. That is 0.3%. The Nasdaq off 255 points. That is 0.2%. The S&P 500 dropped 97 points, 3% there. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mehmetoglu, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong.
New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.